When you hear about carbon emissions on farms, it's usually things like livestock that spring to mind. What you might not think of is something that's a pretty common sight, the Humble Dam. New research, though, that's just been released says that dams account for up to 5% of all agricultural carbon emissions in Victoria. Nikolai Bailhart spoke with researcher Quinn Oliver, a PhD candidate at Deakin Uni.
With any freshwater system, such as inland wetlands or lakes, they're ideal environments for microbe communities, which are going to break down all that plant and animal material heading into the system, and then they're going to respire or release potent greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane, just like we would when we munch on things and then breathe out. So I guess there'd not been much research into farm dams until recently, and we wanted to really get in there and quantify to see if they're going to be large emitters or not.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that they're one of the highest emitters of all freshwater systems globally. So we ramped up our farm dams that we did through Ballarat and Geelong to the Victoria wide, and we found they're emitting around 5,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent per day, which is roughly 380,000, you know, average petrol cars on the road per day, or $500,000 at the carbon price.
And how do you calculate how much emissions are coming out of dams?
That's a bit of a complicated question, but essentially what we do is we go onto the dam in itself and we set up a portable laser machine, essentially, which is going to measure the amount of gases coming out from the water surface into the atmosphere per unit time. And then we can ramp that up based on the other environmental variables to account for very similar systems.
And so you've touched on this already a bit, but to kind of expand on it a bit, I guess in kind of layman's terms, how does water in a hole create emissions?
Yeah, so it really is this idea that you've got all of this material from farming practices, say, you know, especially with the farm dam system, that's going into these little watery systems. And those aquatic systems are niche environments for the microbes, which are going to break down and eat all of that material. And as they eat it, they release it, and then that's going to go straight into the atmosphere. So the biggest question is, how much are they releasing? You know, how many microbes are there? How much material is going in? How much is it converting into our Australian emissions? And we found that they're absolute hotspots. So per metre squared, they're, you know, 3.1 times higher than the closest freshwater rival.
Do you know why that is? Why it's higher?
Well, we're guessing that it's mostly because of you've got an increased amount of fertilisation and plant material from cropping systems, and also the effluent runoff from your stocking, you know, sheep and cattle and whatnot going into these systems. So there's a very large abundance of material that can be broken down, and that's the hypothesis around the study.
Right, and yeah, so when you talk about materials going into dams, is it, so it's a mixture of things, but I imagine fertilisers is part of it, animal waste, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Animal waste and fertilizer were big ones. And in fact, we did find that nitrate concentrations, so the nutrients of nitrates, which are in fertilizer and also in animal waste, were very highly correlated with the emissions. So there is a strong relationship between what's going in and how much is being emitted.
So with news like this coming out, obviously dams play such a vital role on so many farms. Do you imagine there'll be pressure put on farmers long term to cut how many dams they have or how much emissions are coming out of those dams?
I highly doubt it. So with any study like this, with any climate change or emission study, there's three major parts. The first one is to, you know, understand the carbon budget. So you take a sector such as agriculture and you understand how much emissions you're getting. So what this paper does is that first part, and we say that the farm dams are emitting around 5% of all agricultural emissions, say in Victoria. Then the next part is to understand the environmental conditions or drivers of those emissions. So if we link it to nitrates, then we can start with the third part, which is where government can say and offer and come up with management mechanisms that could, say, recompense landholders for voluntary replantation of natural vegetation, which would inherently suck up a lot of those nutrients and possibly reduce the emissions. But this would be a scheme that is open to landholders starting up too if they wanted to. And from everyone I worked with, all the landholders, they were the go-getters. They were the ones who really wanted to make the change on their land, and they also knew their land better than anyone else. So if anything, I think it would just give more money to landholders to do what they already want to do.
And just to expand on that, so is there a clear way to try and cut those emissions? Are there simple things people could do?
There are clear things that we hypothesise. but we don't know yet. So because we're in the first stage of this research, the next stage would be to take our major findings, so the things that related to those emissions, and then try and implement them through a couple tests. And then once we can implement and understand, then we'll do the policies. But we're leaning towards nutrient management. So it would be animal waste management or a replantation of natural vegetation around the dam.
Quinn Oliver there, a PhD candidate at Deakin's Blue Carbon Lab. Well, climate change could also be increasing the alcohol content of wine. That's according to growers in the Coonawarra in South Australia, who say that the hot, dry summers are ripening grapes quickly, leading to earlier harvests and therefore heavier wines. Bruce Redman from Redman Wines says he's had to start planting new varieties and change his vineyard management to combat the impacts of climate change.
Certainly things over the 40-odd years that I've been involved in the wine industry in Coonawarra, we're seeing some fairly distinct climatic differences between the various decades. The 60s, 70s and 80s are all very cool, quite wet generally in terms of vintages, whereas the last 18 years from the 2000s and this decade up to 2018 have tended to be drier and warmer.
So would you say that climate change at all is a concern to you, or rather that the higher temperatures are actually beneficial to your wine grapes?
It's probably a little bit of both. Obviously, one of the hallmarks of Coonawarra is our Cabernet Sauvignon and the distinctive characteristics we get in Cabernet, and that's as a result of cooler climates. If we get too much warm weather and our vintage comes forward too much, we start harvesting too early, then obviously the grapes are going to be riper and there'll be different characteristics in the wine. But at the moment, we're finding we're getting some really lovely wines, probably a little bit higher in alcohol than they were, again, in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and even 80s and even the 90s, which in some ways is good, but we don't want to go too much higher.
And with the earlier ripening of the grapes, what exactly happens to the grape itself?
What we're finding is basically we're getting pretty similar characteristics in terms of aromas and flavours, but we're tending to find that in the last 20-odd years, the alcohols have probably tended to creep up from around 13 to 13.5% to sort of 13.5% to 14% by volume. So the grapes are producing, or the vines are producing more sugar in the grapes. So we're seeing just slightly higher alcohol percentages.
And Professor for Plant Science and Viticulture Stephen Tyerman from the University of Adelaide says the impacts of climate change on Australia's wine industry are quite visible.
Grapevines have often been called the canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. And the reason is that their stages of development are very sensitive to temperature. So when the temperature is warming up, what happens is that things tend to happen earlier. Flowering happens earlier, bud burst happens earlier first, then flowering happens earlier, then veraison happens earlier. That's when the berries start to expand and change colour, if they're red grapes. And so all that happens earlier, and the result is that the berries are then ripening in a earlier part of the year, which is usually hotter. It's like a double whammy. You've got the effect of high temperature on the development, which makes everything happen earlier. And then because of that, the berries are then ripening in a hotter part of the year, in addition to the fact that the temperature's gone up.
And when that is happening, what does that do to the sugar content and the alcohol content in the grapes?
Basically, it tends to allow the sugar to accumulate more rapidly. So basically the ripening process happens a little faster. But more importantly is the potential effect on the flavours that develop in the berry. You know, to get a good wine, you have to sort of have an optimum when the berries ripen and to allow the flavours to develop concurrently with the ripening with the sugar. So if that gets out of balance, like if the sugar's ripened too fast but the flavour hasn't developed, you'll end up, you know, the winemakers might wait for them to develop their flavour, but the sugar's increasing. So the net result is that you end up with higher sugars, which then results in higher alcohol. One of the problems, because of the vintage compression, because things are happening quicker with the warmer temperatures, it's logistically more difficult to get the berries to the winery.
So seeing that, how concerning is climate change then to Australian growers?
It should be very, they should be very concerned. You know, it's insidious the way it creeps up on us because, you know, if you look at vintage variation from year to year, you know, sometimes you have a hot year, sometimes you have a cold year, and that's happening, you know, and the grower's seeing these changes from year to year, and that goes on all the time. But underneath that, you've got this gradual increase in the mean temperature. So what happens every now and then is, well, if we get a hot year, like we always usually get, you know, every now and then you get a hot year, the trouble is that's on top of a higher mean temperature. And so then the peak, the higher temperatures become too extreme.
Looking into the future of the Australian wine industry, are there any certain techniques that growers can implement to actually counteract climate change or prevent their grapes from ripening early?
Yeah. First of all, there are big differences between varieties. You know, it depends on the variety, and each variety has a sort of sweet spot for their temperature optimum where you get the best outcome, the highest quality wine. A lot of Australian wine growing regions tend to be, you know, they can be close to that optimum in terms of the temperature, but often with warming happening, it's starting to go on the high side, which tends to, in general, reduce the quality. So, you know, you can select varieties that are more tolerant of the higher temperatures. But also there are techniques that are available. A lot of these are only just in their trial stage. So, for example, misting, so using water to mist into the canopies can cool down the canopies during heat waves. Shading is a big deal. You know, if you want to put in overhead shading, that's a big expense, but it does have a big impact.
Professor for Plant Science and Viticulture, Dr. Stephen Tyman from the University of Adelaide, finishing that report by Jessica Schremer. Now, for people shivering through the icy Northern Hemisphere winter, wool is the perfect antidote. But during the recent round of global textile trade expos, major fashion houses were on the hunt for something a bit cheaper. As Clint Jasper found out, fashion giants are pushing back against the meteoric rise in wool prices.
The outfits you see coming down a runway are the end product of a process that started nearly a year ago.
Yeah, that's correct. The major shows take place in China, Europe and the US, most of them in September, October, what's just passed.
International Wool Consulting's Jimmy Jackson works for some of China's largest textile manufacturers.
The buyers are coming to them shows to meet these suppliers, whether it's garments, yarns, fabric, whatever, to see what they're going to perhaps run with for the following autumn, winter, Northern Hemisphere. So that means 1919, maybe starting October, the run up to Christmas, and then a couple of months after that, during the sale period.
And what's the meteoric rise in the wool price done for the interest in how much wool those people want to buy and what types of wool?
Well, unfortunately, price has gone up too quickly. We managed last year to get them to accept the price. The manufacturers I work with couldn't pass on the full price, so they had to take some of the costs themselves. So we managed last year, but now it's just gone up, unfortunately, just a bit too high and too quickly. So now there's a pushback and asking us about merino blends. And we was prepared for that. In fact, all the yarns and fabrics we've developed over the past year, 18 months, in the run-up to this show, all contain all the blends.
Those blends include a range of synthetic fibres like polyester and acrylic that make clothing lighter and improve the stretch. But critically, with wool prices so high, they also make them cheaper. In a presentation to the International Sourcing Expo in Melbourne this week, a senior analyst from the Chinese Chamber of Commerce for Import and Export of Textiles, or CCT for short, said Chinese buyers were becoming very sensitive to the price rises. Ms. Yuxing Zhu says while Chinese customers love wool, especially in the colder parts of the country, there's a limit to how much they're prepared to pay.
In recent 2 years, the cost of wool has skyrocketed, and this has never happened in the history before. The changing cost of wool will certainly lead Chinese consumers to change to other alternatives other than buying wool products. And demand for wool products will decrease due to recent price changes.
It's unlikely the price of wool will change anytime soon. The drought on the East Coast means the clip will be down by about 10% compared to last year. Grazier Angus White from Pooncarie in far west New South Wales says the dry conditions mean he's only stocking about 25% of the usual amount of sheep.
Yeah, pretty low numbers. Certainly up until now, a buoyant wool market has helped retain good sheep prices. So destocking has been a reasonably easy decision with the current price of sheep, and that's helped enormously by wool.
Obviously the market's been extremely good, as you mentioned, over the past year. We've had those successive record-breaking auctions. In recent times, the price has started to come off a bit as overseas buyers kind of reach the limit of what they can pay. So does that create a kind of concerning situation given what the weather's doing at the moment and the low stock numbers you're running?
The market coming back, it certainly isn't unexpected. It's in any sort of market, high prices usually push closer towards low prices because you can't, you know, while the farmers might be really appreciating the high prices, the processor, on the other hand, might be saying, well, I just can't keep going on doing this. So that usually results in a turnaround and the balance in the other way.
China buys the bulk of Australia's clip, and while high prices have seen buyers drop out of the market in recent weeks, there's a range of geopolitical events, including the US-China trade war, that are weighing on business sentiment across China. And Jimmy Jackson says textile manufacturers are not exempt from that.
Yeah, it's reducing confidence, the element of nervousness.
So what we can expect in a lot of the clothes coming out of the major brands in the next autumn-winter season will be a lot more woolen blends, yeah. A lot less raw woolen products.
It seems that way. Now, of course, there's going to be less because there's simply going to be less wool available, unfortunately, due to the drought. And also, there's an issue of the quality now. You know, to make a beautiful 100% wool product and men's suiting, you need beautiful wool, beautiful length, colour and strength. We can use inferior wools when it comes to blending because usually if we blend with synthetic fibres, you know, naturally it makes the garment stronger. So we can get away with using, you know, weaker wools and maybe even a couple of micron coarser.
The Australian Wool Exchange's Lionel Plunkett says the increased blending may be the new normal until supply can catch up.
Substitution like that is fairly common once prices start to get ahead of themselves. But, you know, bearing in mind, I think we've got to keep it in perspective. We have had some really good rises over the last few years preceding the sharp rises from last year. We actually had a really good base build-up. We had steady price improvements. And then we saw that sharp lift. So I think it's probably a matter of, you know, managing expectations both at the sell level and at the end user level. And trying to push those prices through to consumers, and there's price expectations there as well that's got to be managed.
With the average price of a bale of wool sitting between $2,500 and $3,000, wool growers are celebrating the market surge. But retail fashion consumers, forever on the hunt for a bargain, will be a harder sell.